The Ideas Network, I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. In the past decade, geek culture has become mainstream pop culture. Simultaneously, the rise of social media has given fans more modes to participate in entertainment. Our guest explains how the media industry pays attention to a select cohort of voices and tends to overlook the diverse audiences that have always been there. What do you think about how women are portrayed in pop culture? What about how women are portrayed in video games? What diverse characters in superhero or science fiction movies and television have you appreciated, and why? What's your take on the recent blockbusters featuring diverse characters like Star Wars, Wonder Woman, Captain Marvel, and the new Ghostbusters movie? Are you a diverse member of geek culture who has felt overlooked until now? Tell us what your experiences have been online and at the box office, and have you paid attention to the backlash some of this diversity in pop culture has received online, and why do you think that happens? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Suzanne Scott is a professor of radio, TV, and film at the University of Texas at Austin. Her writing and research focuses on fan studies, comic book culture, and gender studies. She's the author of Fake Geek Girls, Fandom, Gender, and the Convergence of the Convergence Culture Industry. Suzanne, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was remarking to the producers before we went on the air that I'm old enough to remember when we settled differences over which was better, DC or Marvel, in the school lunchroom. Now we go online and duke it out. It's a lot more complicated than that. But there have been a lot of changes in this culture over the decades. For those of us who aren't active participants in the geek media world, help us break down some of the changes we've seen in pop culture, specifically over the last 10 years.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I also was there when we were having these fights in the lunchroom and not on Twitter or on Tumblr. So I've sort of seen this transition happen as a fan, but also as an academic. So over the past decade, we've seen the industry really need fans in a way they haven't historically. Fans used to be this kind of niche subcultural group. They were often the most active media consumers, the most active participants in media culture, but they often weren't the most valuable audience. And what we've seen as we've moved towards a sort of post-Web 2.0 landscape, as we've moved towards a culture that is very much more dialogic, much more participatory, in which the industry needs fans to sort of engage as promotional partners, they need them to have that kind of level of engagement that fans have historically had. We've seen a sort of revaluation of fans within the media industries. Now, obviously, that revaluation treats different types of fans and different types of fan engagement differently. So, the practices we have historically associated with female fans, so things like the creation of transformative works, things like fan fiction, fan art, fan video, sort of the creative practices of fans, are still seen as somewhat threatening to media industries, either ideologically or legally. The kinds of fan practices we have historically associated with men, the more affirmational fan practices, things like collecting, curating, knowing every bit of flora and fauna within the Star Wars galaxy, those practices have become increasingly valuable. And so as a result, what you've seen is the industry reaching out to fans as promotional partners, as tastemakers, as a very valuable demographic. But that has skewed sort of overwhelmingly towards an idea that men sort of have always existed at the center of this culture, which is fundamentally untrue, but that they still sort of are the most valuable subset of that culture.
You make a really important point about the existence of fandom. I mean, it's been around for a long time. It didn't just pop into existence when Twitter showed up.
Exactly.
And there was, I remember seeing, starting to see a ton of fan fiction about just about every genre you could think of on the internet in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And so this has been around for a long time. But now, for some reason, we're finally starting to pay attention to some of it, but maybe not in the best way. In 2017, Marvel Comics Vice President of Marketing David Gabriel made some comments that incited somewhat of a backlash. Briefly tell us what happened there.
Yeah, so I opened the book with this anecdote about this executive at Marvel who was sort of blaming a slump in sales on their sort of turn towards more diverse superhero titles. So over the years, but particularly he'd blame this on a turn towards female characters and female-driven titles and the perceived lack of desire for those characters. And of course, you know, people immediately challenged these logics. They pointed to comic books like Ms. Marvel that are selling very well. But I think that it sort of showed that they continue to remain invested. Geek industry continues to remain invested in this, what they sort of colloquially refer to as their meat and potatoes audience, right? And that meat and potatoes audience is sort of generally understood to be straight white men who are about 18 to 34. This is not coincidentally the target demographic for almost all media, right? The most valuable demographic. And so what happened was, you saw him claim that, you know, he was hearing from various comic book retailers that there just wasn't a market for this stuff. There wasn't a desire for it. And then, you know, I think people very quickly online sort of pushed back on this notion and talked about the fact that simply because this idea that this is the sort of what they envision to be their core audience, the audience that they are sort of most interested in courting, this sort of leaves us sort of stagnant in terms of where we push forward, how we acknowledge how the audience has already diversified, or even more to the point, how we acknowledge that the diverse audience has always been there. I think there's another problem here that, like, fan culture is not new, but the diversity of fan culture has also always been there. And I think part of the problem is a lack of acknowledgement that, you know, queer people, people of color, women, they've always been orbiting around comic book culture. They've always been orbiting around video game culture, but they're not visible and they're not sort of valued in the same ways.
Is it because they don't shout loud enough?
Well, I mean, I think that what's interesting right now, when we see what's getting covered in terms of fan culture, I think there are really interesting parallels to be made between fan culture right at this given moment with social media and our current sort of political polarization, which is to say, you know, the people at the various polls seem to be shouting the loudest. So when we see media coverage of fans, we're often seeing coverage of either the most kind of toxic, violent, misogynist, racist components of fan culture, or on the other end of the spectrum, we are seeing coverage of the most progressive activist ends of fan culture. And so we're losing a kind of large audience in the middle.
Suzanne Scott is a professor of media and the author of Fake Geek Girls, Fandom, Gender, and the Convergence Culture Industry. I want to know what you think about this. What do you think about, for example, how women are portrayed in pop culture or how they're represented in fandom and whether they're paid attention to or not? Do you feel appreciated by the people who are creating content for you? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Suzanne Scott stays with us throughout this entire hour as we discuss this whole issue of convergence culture and fandom and things like that. Want to know, you know, where you are on all of this. 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. When we come back, want to kind of follow up where we were with the decision makers in the industry and how they view women and diverse audience members, and get your impressions on that, Suzanne Scott. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Geek culture has become pop culture over the past decade, and characters have become more diverse. But not everybody is entirely happy about that. What do you think about how women and minorities are portrayed in pop culture? What about how they're portrayed in video games? What diverse characters in superhero or science fiction movies and television have you appreciated? and why? Do you feel appreciated by the industry if you're a member of one of the groups that's underrepresented in online forums and things like that? How do you feel the industry is valuing you and your points of view? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Suzanne Scott is a professor of radio, TV, and film at the University of Texas at Austin. Her writing and research focuses on fan studies, comic book culture, and gender studies. She's the author of the book Fake Geek Girls, Fandom, Gender, and the Convergence Culture Industry. We had an email from Paul in Eau Claire who shares that he has spent thousands of hours in comic book shops, and it's mostly straight white males that you see there. He asked why even this escape to a fantasy needs diversity.
Well, I think there are two different points there. I've had the exact opposite experience in a lot of comic book shops. I think some of this comes down to the space of the comic book shop and whether it is or is not a welcoming space. Anecdotally, I've heard a lot of evidence from female fans, fans of color, that if they go into a comic book shop and they are immediately kind of interrogated for their mere presence, you know, why are you here? Do you know this particular issue of Batman, et cetera, et cetera? They often will feel unwelcome and will leave. I think that's changed over the past several years as the sort of audience has diversified. I think, and frankly, we need diversity in these fantasy spaces because we need it to reflect our real world. I mean, I think these are often fantasies of power. I think it's frankly fairly dangerous to think that those fantasies should be reserved exclusively for white straight men or white straight male characters. I think that perpetuates a lot of power imbalances in our society. And so frankly, you know, I think that the comic book space, the comic book shop should be welcoming to everyone. I want to be really clear that when I talk about, you know, white straight men in comic book culture or in geek culture generally, and I'm talking about a very specific subset of fanboys that sort of seem to take umbrage to the mere presence of women in these spaces or the presence of diversity in their media. I don't think that represents a large swath of fanboys or even white straight fanboys right now in the culture. But I do think that, like, frankly, our media should reflect our environment. It should reflect our society. And I think part of the problem here is that, part of the problem here and something that I cover in the book is about who can more easily kind of mobilize and trade on their fan identities for professional success. So when you see the kinds of people who are getting hired to helm all these geek media properties, whether they're sort of franchise films in the MCU or whether they're, you know, new runs on comic books, these are still overwhelmingly white men. And so we get this kind of vicious cycle that emerges in which the same people who are producing the content then often will put characters that reflect their own identities in the content, and then in turn, the audience is seen to have those identities as well. And I think that's a really problematic cycle to encourage.
In the past few years, the inclusion of diverse characters or new forms of characters in pop culture has gotten a lot of attention. The all-female Ghostbusters remake, a female Jedi, a black stormtrooper in The Force Awakens, the return of Wonder Woman. There's a lot more out there. Captain Marvel. You write that we view these diverse projects as a zero-sum game. What do you mean by that?
I'm just saying that I think oftentimes there is a logic that sort of that is underlying the kind of negative response to the arrival of diverse characters, diverse superheroes, diverse franchise films, where the idea is that to have a female Jedi means that there will be no more male Jedis, which is just fundamentally untrue. So this idea that, like, more for me if I am a woman within geek culture, or more for me if I am a person of color in geek culture, means that there will be less for you. And fundamentally, that's just not the case. Not only because, you know, minorities are still very underrepresented in all of these things. We only, you know, like, we can't hinge all of our hopes on one Black Panther movie or one Captain Marvel movie. But this idea that, that ultimately, it's frankly a kind of very childish logic of sort of thinking about, like, my toys will be taken away, right? The things that I love and the things that I have historically grown up with will no longer be mine. And that sense of ownership, I think, is really common in fan culture, the sense of ownership over media objects. We spend so much time devoting our energy and our love and our time to these things. That's not necessarily a bad thing. I think it becomes a bad thing and it becomes a toxic thing when you sort of don't acknowledge that other people would be very excited to see themselves reflected in these properties as well.
Let's take the example of the all-female Ghostbusters remake. I mean, that just got absolutely attacked online. People just saying there's just no way this is, nobody should go and see this, blah, blah, blah. And then the attacks on the Captain Marvel character saying, oh, this movie's going to flop, it's going to fail. Of course, it didn't. It was very successful. But what's going on here?
I think one of the problems is any of these movies that you see that tends to center women, it is demanded culturally and industrially that it overperform. It can't just make its budget back. It can't just be marginally successful. It has to be a runaway success. And I think, frankly, I think marginalized fans know this, and it's part of the reason why they show up in force when, say, a Captain Marvel movie comes out or a Wonder Woman movie comes out, because they know that that is what the industry values most. The case with Ghostbusters is an interesting one, and one that I, frankly, as a very massive Ghostbusters fan, found a little bit confounding. It would be one thing if they were sort of rebooting Ghostbusters as like a dark family melodrama, and they were fundamentally altering some of the fabric of the conceit and the tone and the genre. They weren't doing that. They were simply casting women in these historically male roles. Part of the reason that movie was not as successful, that I don't think we're talking about as frequently, is the fact that it had a massive budget. So it had to overcome a lot. It was sort of set up to fail in some ways economically from the get-go. But I think a lot of the response to that did show in very explicit and very unfortunate ways the way that misogyny and racism and the combination thereof is still very pervasive within some corners of geek culture. So it's not coincidental that most of this hate was targeted at Leslie Jones, right? But I also want to say that, you know, we have these sort of spectacular incidents that get a lot of media coverage. The boycott of Ghostbusters, for example, or things like Gamergate. These are the things that we see covered in the news and that kind of make it into the mainstream cultural consciousness. For every one of those incidents, we have daily systemic kind of incidents of women within geek culture being told that they're unwelcome, that they're inauthentic, that they are fake. And I don't want to sort of lose those subtler or systemic incidents within these big spectacular moments of harassment and hate campaigns, because I think they're, in some ways, they're not on the same level, but I think they're equally damaging.
So then you have a huge box office success like Captain Marvel. How are the responses different then from the industry and the fan world when you've got an obvious hit like this?
Captain Marvel was really interesting because I think the book is a little bit cynical. I think it's safe to say about the state of how the industry values female fans. And I was I've been going to Comic-Con for well over a decade. So I sort of saw the initial kind of moment when Captain Marvel was announced. I got very excited. I'm a big fan of the Kelly Sue DeConnick's comics run. And I kept then seeing the release date get pushed back and get pushed back and get pushed back. And to be perfectly honest with you, I was a little shocked when it finally was sort of real and coming out because it seemed like it was not a priority for them. And I know there's a lot of internal planning that has to happen with the MCU that was probably part of that. But for a while, it looked there like they were sort of pushing it on their back burner. I think, frankly, that like given how big the MCU is and how massively popular it is, and how diverse its audience is, to be perfectly frank, I think that it was long overdue. I think, frankly, there's a lot of discourse that still happens in the industry around female superhero properties being tricky. They like the word tricky, or they like the word, you know, and I think they like that word because it lets them say, sort of in a veiled way, that they're not sure that men will be as accepting of these characters. And ultimately, that conveys to me that women still remain or are still configured as a sort of surplus audience. They're not thought of as being the core audience for a superhero movie, even though they've been showing up now for 22, you know, 20 some odd Marvel movies. And so I think that I was really unsurprised by Captain Marvel's success. I'm always surprised at how surprised the industry is when a Wonder Woman or a Captain Marvel does well. You see the trades the next day and it's like, oh, it overperformed. We're really pleasantly surprised. And I sort of always want to say, you know, shake them and say, like, why are you pleasantly surprised? Women have been going to these movies for a long time.
Up next, we have the news, and then we will continue our discussion with you and with Suzanne Scott, professor of media and the author of Fake Geek Girls, Fandom, Gender, and the Convergence Culture Industry. We've got some callers starting to arrive, and we will take those phone calls when we return. We'll also explore the rise of convergence culture and how it's changed how we interact with media. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about fandom and geek culture. We're exploring the rise of convergence culture and how it's changed how we interact with media. Are you a diverse member of geek culture who has felt overlooked until now? Tell us what your experience has been online and at the box office. Have you been paying attention to the backlash to some of this diversity in pop culture? Why do you think it happens? Are you happy about the diversity of characters in pop culture? If not, what makes you feel that way? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Suzanne Scott is professor of radio, TV, and film at the University of Texas at Austin. Her writing and research focuses on fan studies, comic book culture, and gender studies. She's the author of Fake Geek Girls, Fandom, Gender, and the Convergence Culture Industry. And we do have some calls. Let's go to the phone, and we'll hear from David first in Fort Atkinson. David, hello.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a 63-year-old white guy. I like sci-fi movies, Guardians of the Galaxy, Star Wars, whatever. But one thing I've noticed here is that if they have a strong female character there, they generally have, like, a half-witted dude as their partner, man. They have a strong man character. They have, like, a bumbling woman. It seems like Hollywood just, they stereotype themselves. Like, if you have a black character, it's, you know, they have a gay character. They need to bring people into where the world is today. I mean, in my own family, my daughter-in-laws and a lot of women, young women around me, and even my 36-year marriage to my wife, we work together. And I think what Ghostbusters thing is, Hollywood keeps hitting these. It hits me wrong because they, you know, wife beating dad or you know, guys are just stupid. They shouldn't be doing that anymore because in my own family, we're beyond that right now. And I think if they had two strong characters, a woman and a man, equally working together as a, you know, would go a long way. They got to stop hitting the, you know, like the man is no good or the woman's stupid. They're still doing that. And if you catch, you watch some of these movies, they're still doing it.
Okay, we get it. David, thanks for your comment. Suzanne?
Yeah, David, thanks for saying that. I really appreciate that comment. As you were talking, I couldn't help but think that I think that the one media property that's perhaps like most emblematic of both the thing that's causing a lot of pushback from men within geek culture right now, but also that sort of shows their ascendance to be this sort of target demographic is something like The Big Bang Theory, right? Which completely trades in horrible stereotypes about fanboys, right? But simultaneously, it also is like a pretty unprecedented show to be on the air right now. It's the most popular show on the air right now. And I think that what's interesting is, like, you wouldn't have an entire show orbiting around geeky characters like that even, you know, 20 years ago. So, in the one sense, Big Bang Theory really shows the ascendance of, you know, geeks and fans as a target demographic. On the other, it shows the precise kinds of stereotypes and pathologies that have long been associated with fans that I think a lot of male fans, when they see this kind of, like, you know, movement from the margins to the mainstream, now that the thing that they used to get picked on for is now really popular, they still feel like they are still being stereotyped in those ways. And that's really unfair. And I agree with you that I think culturally, we definitely have sort of, we're trying to move beyond these cultural stereotypes as much as we humanly can. I would love it if the mainstream media industry would be a little bit more reflective of that. And I think in some cases, we are seeing some good progress on that front, but it certainly could do better.
You mentioned The Big Bang Theory. What about Young Sheldon, the spinoff?
I will admit that I have not watched Young Sheldon, so I can't speak to that. One thing I will say, though, is I do think that, like, you know, there's something to be said about The Big Bang Theory that, like, women have a really hard time or are very much portrayed or laughed at for not being able to sort of understand geeky references or occupy the same fan roles that the men have on that show. And so in the book, I talk a little bit about the fact that, like, even though those stereotypes are terrible, there's something equally pernicious about the fact that men are still centered in that narrative in terms of being able to easily occupy fan and geek and technological identities where women are not.
Some on the internet were upset about the all-female scene in the most recent Avengers movie. They said it was pandering. What was your take on that?
I also thought it was pandering, actually. I didn't think it was earned, I guess is what I would say about it. I'll say my piece about it, and then I want to offer a counterpoint, which is... So I really felt like that moment had not been earned by Marvel. You know, they bring all their female characters together, many of whom had had very minimal screen time in Endgame and in pretty much every Marvel property going forward, to sort of prove that they were doing well on the diversity front, at least as far as women were going. And I didn't think that was especially earned. It did feel a bit pandering. I will say that I have a bunch of friends who are raising geek girls right now, and they all loved that moment. So I get torn in these moments between feeling like, you know, Marvel wants to pat itself on the back for something it's not actually doing, and Disney as well. But I also feel like those moments are important for young girls to see themselves represented on screen in that way. And so I am pretty ambivalent about those moments, to be perfectly honest.
Let's take another call. Chris is with us on line 3 from Oshkosh. Chris, go ahead.
Hi. First off, I agree with just about everything you're saying. It's fantastic for people to see themselves represented on screen, no matter what sex, race, anything. I think that's awesome. My comment is just one brief thing, and that's the Ghostbusters reboot. I actually love all the actresses that were in the movie. I think it really didn't have so much to do for a lot of people with the actresses. It's a reboot. You run the risk of not being as good of the original. It's a classic, and it wasn't. It wasn't as good of a movie. And the other thing that I just wanted to touch on was I thought it was not the coolest move to make the character that was Janine, which would be the secretary, who was played by Annie Potts, you know, she was kind of a rough New York person, and they kind of made it like a complete ditzy guy. And I thought that was kind of not a cool move. I mean, Janine wasn't a ditzy person. She was a typical New Yorker. But I think that was a lot of the backlash from hardcore Ghostbusters fans was, you're remaking Ghostbusters. Period. I mean, it's the same when they remade The Dukes of Hazzard. People were upset with that. Anytime you're remaking a classic, you're going to run the risk of it better be really good. And the movie was good. It wasn't as good as the original. And I don't think it had so much to do with women taking the roles. I think it just wasn't. It's hard to live up to a classic. And that's just kind of my take. I'm sure there were, you know, people that are not cool that were, you know, upset because it was women. But I think overall that was one of the reasons the film had a problem.
Okay. Chris, we get it. Suzanne?
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with everything that you just said. I do think that, you know, this is part of the perils of living in a reboot culture, right? Where intellectual property is constantly being recycled. We're not seeing a lot of new original content coming out. This is just something we're going to have to grapple with, I think, as a culture, and geek culture in particular is going to have to grapple with it. I agree with you that, you know, first of all, I completely agree on the Janine point. I am a huge Janine stan from back in the day. So I completely agree that that seemed like a poor choice on the part of the filmmakers. I will say this though. I mean, I think it's fine to go see the movie and then have problems with the movie or feel like it didn't live up to the original in particular ways. What I'm really talking about is before these movies even come out, they see a degree of pushback and hate and anxiety around them that is sort of unfounded. By all means, go see the movie. You can like it, you can not like it. I think that's a completely different scenario. What I will say is, you know, the Ghostbusters fans who did do this sort of hate campaign against the reboot before it even came out, what worries me is that we now are getting a Ghostbuster, yet another Ghostbusters reboot with the original cast or the living original cast. And so it feels a bit like a win for those people, and I think it might endorse those similar harassment tactics in another scenario. And those are the things that kind of make me nervous.
We had an email from Rachel in Eau Claire who shared that she is a non-binary trans person and she will be forever grateful to Alan Moore, who wrote the graphic novel V for Vendetta. He had even wanted an overtly transgender hero for that book, but was forced to make it more covert by DC Comics. Happily, the transgender Wachowski sisters later adapted it for film.
Yeah, no, I'm so happy to hear that comment, Rachel. And I think part of the problem, frankly, and I'll just say, you know, I talk a lot about fanboys and fangirls in the book, and I acknowledge from the outset that these are really essentialist identities, right? And in some ways, they're more conceptual than even, you know, lived identities, right? We talk about fanboys sort of generally. We talk about fangirls generally. There are plenty of women who behave like fanboys and vice versa, right? In terms of their consumption habits, the ways they like to engage with geek and fan culture, the kinds of media properties they orbit around, and so on. One of the things I think I don't talk about in the book sufficiently is sort of thinking about the ways in which our current sort of spectrum of gender identities plays into this. So yes, I agree. I think particularly in comics, we've seen a lot of missteps around trans characters over the past 5 years as well. I hope that's changing. I hope it's not just a matter of making these overt and not covert, but actually sort of very rich representations of trans identity. I mean, we saw Batgirl have a kind of misstep with this a couple years ago. And so I am tentatively, cautiously optimistic that these things will change. But I think a lot of the issue here is, you know, the Wachowski sisters got brought up. And I think part of this is about making sure that we're not just diversifying representations, but we're diversifying production cultures. And so making sure that we are affording opportunities for diverse creators to sort of make their way in Hollywood.
Why do we pay so much attention to people who insist geek culture be inherently masculine?
I mean, you sort of mentioned earlier in our conversation, well, are they just the loudest voice in the room? And sometimes that is the case. It can often feel like that is the pervasive opinion when you are on a space like Twitter, where those voices are often very loud, they're very aggressive, and they're, you know, sort of flooding people's mentions with, complaints and hate speech. I think, honestly, part of the issue here is that even when creators try to appeal to diverse audiences, so I'll give you a really quick example. J.J. Abrams, when promoting The Force Awakens, sort of made a quick offhand comment, you know, Star Wars has always been a boys thing. We're so excited for mothers to bring their daughters to this movie. And that's okay. Great. But it sort of does say that, you know, boys are still the central audience for this thing.
And we'll pick this conversation up in just a moment. We're with Suzanne Scott, the professor of media and author of Fake Geek Girls. We're talking about that. Today on The Morning Show. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about fandom, geek culture, convergence culture, and the reaction to more diversity to characters we see portrayed in media. What do you think? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Suzanne Scott is a professor of radio, TV, and film at the University of Texas at Austin. Her writing and research focuses on fan studies, comic book culture, and gender studies. She's the author of Fake Geek Girls, Fandom, Gender, and the Convergence Culture Industry. We have an email from Christine who shared that she loves the new Star Trek on CBS. She said she thinks the show is stronger for its diverse cast, including sexual minorities and characters of color. Suzanne, does that give you hope that we're moving in the right direction?
Absolutely. You know, I also love that show, and I think it's a good indicator of maybe where we're headed. What I think is interesting about Discovery is the fact that it's on CBS All Access, right? So I think I'm always looking at the ways in which the industry is signaling either to sort of how they imagine their audience for sort of geek media properties, but I also am interested in sort of how they are courting them. So on the one hand, you could sort of positively spin this and say, you know, they knew this diverse audience for Star Trek already existed. I mean, the legacy of that franchise is one that is based on diversity. And so I think that on the one hand, you know, there were sort of horizons that that franchise had not crossed until Star Trek Discovery in terms of different types of representation that I'm glad to see it finally doing. And I think that they knew a diverse audience would be interested in that show. And you can make a case that they were sort of like, well, this is a great property to launch CBS All Access with, or to draw people to this new streaming platform that we're trying to make popular. I also think it's interesting, though, that they maybe didn't feel like it could function on CBS, like the network, and maybe that it didn't have enough mass appeal or enough of a mass audience to sort of orbit in that space. So I'm always a little bit torn in these examples, in part because I always sort of wonder what they reflect about a true understanding of diverse audiences as a mass audience. I still think there's a kind of intellectual, you know, separation there.
Let's take another call. John is with us in Lake Halley. John, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a couple of comments. I owned a game store for over a decade, and I've noticed the people that I directly dealt with, the whole diversity issue when there was something new, female Doctor Who, Jedis, whatever, no one had a problem with it. The only people that seem to have a problem are the online vocal minorities of these fan bases.
All right. John in Lake Halley says he's not seeing that in his store.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that, first of all, John. I think that I do think that often what we are talking about is a very small vocal minority of fans online. I also think it's really important to note that there's a lot of overlap here with troll subcultures online. So in the case in which people are sort of harassing, you know, Kelly Marie Tran off of Twitter for daring to be a woman of color in a Star Wars film, I think it's often hard to sort of neatly divorce who are fans who are generally genuinely upset about that and are sort of expressing that directly at the actresses that are portraying these characters, and who is just doing it to provoke a response, right? So when we think about trolls, these are people who are trying to provoke negative responses from people for their own pleasure in digital spaces. To me, you know, I think to just say, well, it's all trolls, they're just doing this to get a rise out of people, dismisses the broader sort of social inequities that underpin these kinds of moments. But I am really happy to hear that that's not the case where you are locally.
John, thanks for that call. Suzanne, we live in a world where fans get to participate on some level in the creation of media and the entertainment they consume. This has been called convergence culture. Explain what convergence culture is and what does it look like in our lives?
Sure. So I'm taking this term from a really wonderful book by Henry Jenkins that came out in 2006. So writing at that moment in time, Jenkins was interested in what he saw as these sort of vast changes that were happening on the industrial level with the media industries, technology in terms of digital media and participatory culture, and also culturally. So audiences and fans in particular play a key role in his narrative, thinking about the ways in which fans fans are sort of demanding more agency and participation within the media construction process. We now have a bunch of venues technologically, and certainly this is the case even after 2006 when Jenkins was writing, spaces in which sort of fans can produce and disseminate their own content. There's sites like social media that emerged after that that obviously give fans a sort of direct line to talk to creators of their favorite media properties in ways they had not historically had outside of like fan message boards in the 90s. And so industrially, there are also all these shifts, as I said at the top of the hour, that were sort of forcing industry to sort of reconsider their relationship to fans, not just as this kind of annoying minority that they weren't really going to cater to, but as real promotional partners and a core demographic for how they might sort of market things going forward. And so I'm interested in the ways in which those shifts, which I think Jenkins was very positive about, he was sort of looking at sort of how this could create much more agency for audiences and a much more participatory and potentially sort of democratized space between media producers and consumers. I will admit that I sort of take up the sort of negative, you know, like evil goatee sort of alternate universe side of this argument in my book. And I look at the sort of past 10 years and how this has actually played out. And so I'm making an argument that, like, yes, we've had all these changes. Yes, you know, things are sort of rapidly evolving on industrial fronts and technological fronts and cultural fronts. But what's emerged out of that is this kind of culture of gatekeeping practices that are sort of being fueled by the ways in which industry values particular subsets of fans and particular types of fan activity, right? When those types are historically driven by men, some small sets of male fans then use that and weaponize that idea against other people within fan culture. And so that's what I'm interested in, thinking about sort of the darker side of the convergence culture.
We've been focusing on the problems within pop culture and geek communities. The fan base, though, is widening. Can we attribute some of the problems we're seeing to growing pains? There are now more of us in the geek sandbox, and we're still learning how to play together, or is that overly simplistic?
I mean, I don't think it's overly simplistic. I think that anytime you think about, you know, what has historically been a subculture moving to the mainstream, there's always anxieties around that. There's always a sense that the people who helped found and build and sort of structure the thing initially, and who put a lot of time and energy and who were maybe kind of critiqued or made fun of for their investment in that thing, are now sort of like, you know, now the thing is popular and they don't see themselves as sort of benefiting the most from that. I do think it's partially growing pains. I do think it's partially just the kind of, you know, sociopolitical moment that we're in, where we're seeing also this sort of anti-feminist pushback in general culturally. We're seeing sort of the emergence of men's rights movements and the alt-right. And I do make a sort of connection in the book to say, you know, if you want to look at some of the origins of these things, or at least sort of like think about the ways in which fandom functions microcosmically to kind of relay these kinds of cultural shifts that are happening, these political shifts that are happening, it's pretty easy to see. If you've been in fan and geek culture over the past decade, I think you are not surprised by many of the sort of political shifts we've seen happen over the past decade.
And I just, my own geek credentials is when I was in high school, I carried a slide rule in a holster.
Well, you don't need to authenticate your geek identity to me. That would be antithetical to the whole book's project, but
got
I appreciate it.
Okay. Suzanne Scott is a professor of radio, TV, and film at the University of Texas at Austin. Her writing and research focuses on fan studies, comic book culture, and gender studies. She's the author of Fake Geek Girls, Fandom, Gender, and the Convergence Culture Industry. Really appreciate your time today, Suzanne. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Just ahead, the Ideas Network brings you On Point. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Laura Pavin, Jenna Rose Schleiss, Courtney Everett, Keegan Kyle, Chris Molina, and Brian Shasso. Lee Rayburn is our technical director, and Keely Bultina is our executive producer. I'm John Munson, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.